supposed to share this resource. It's called Earth Prayers, Prayers and Poems from Around the World, edited by Elizabeth Roberts. It's a new and lovely resource with a variety of really excellent prayers and poetry. And the first thing I'll read is a poem by Wallace Stegner, and the second is a poem from the UN Environmental Sabbath Program. Let us pray. Something will have gone out of us as a people if we ever let the remaining wilderness be destroyed, if we permit the last virgin forests to be turned into comic books and plastic cigarette cases, if we drive the few remaining members of the wild species into zoos or to extinction, if we pollute the last clean air and dirty the last clean streams and push our paved roads through the last of the silence, so that never again will Americans be free in their own country from the noise, the exhausts, the stinks of human and automotive waste, and so that never again can we have the chance to see ourselves single, separate, vertical and individual in the world, part of the environment of trees and rocks and soil, brother and sister to the other animals, part of the natural world, and competent to belong in it. Great Spirit, whose dry lands thirst, help us to find the way to refresh your lands. We pray for your power to refresh your lands. Great Spirit, whose waters are choked with debris and pollution, help us to find the way to cleanse your waters. We pray for your knowledge to find the way to cleanse the waters. Great Spirit, whose beautiful earth grows ugly with misuse, help us to find the way to restore beauty to your handiwork. We pray for your strength to restore the beauty of your handiwork. Great Spirit, whose creatures are being destroyed, help us a way to replenish them. We pray for your power to replenish the earth. Great Spirit, whose gifts to us are being lost in selfishness and corruption, help us to find the way to restore our humanity. We pray for your wisdom to find the way to restore our humanity. Amen. Hi. Come on in. Before I begin, I want to pray your indulgence in my looking at my notes a little more than I like to when I'm teaching, but my kids did not adapt well to the Narnia program and have been screaming most of the day, and my littlest one was screaming as I was trying to get out of here and out of there to come here. So forgive me if the mommy side of my life intrudes into the teacher. I'm going to do a book study today, which I hope won't be dull but interesting. There's a book I read a number of years ago that becomes increasingly interesting and important to me the more I delve into some of these issues. And it was written not by a Christian, but a historian named Frederick Turner, and it's called Beyond Geography, The Western Spirit Against the Wilderness. And it's now in paperback, and I strongly, strongly recommend it. They weren't able to get it here, so it isn't here, but I strongly recommend it. And what I'd like to do today, in order to focus on the wilderness and spirituality and the wilderness, is to use this as a way of looking at myth and story, and use his analysis of the conquest of this continent by Europeans as a way to look at a part of what I agree with him is a part of the spirit of the West. I remember we had moved to Seattle. We'd only been there 2 weeks, and I'd never been west of Kalamazoo, Michigan, where my family on my mother's side lived, and I didn't know what to expect out here. I thought it would be cowboy boots, and I sort of thought of anything in the West as being cowboy boots. But I remember one of the first articles I read in Parade magazine in the Seattle Times was about the wilderness and about wildness, and it said, one line that always stuck in my mind was that there's always been a conflict in the Western spirit between submitting to nature, submitting and being overcome by nature and conquering it. So being conquered and conquering it. And that's always stuck in my mind, and I think that is a tension that is indeed a part of the Western spirit. And Turner has an interesting analysis of the spirituality that is about, and I'll get into that in a minute. As a way of beginning, what I'd like to do is introduce a notion that's become pretty frequent these days in spirituality and ecology circles, and which you may or may not be familiar with. And again, it's John Cobb that I think addresses this the best. He says that the great religions of the world arose during a time when the great concern was redemption. In other words, people were interested in being saved. And you got into that a little bit last night. And salvation from was an issue. And salvation, of course, very often is most oriented to the people who are being saved, and it tends to be anthropocentric. It also very often is racist and sexist, because often the ones that are saved are the males within power. To make a gross generalization, in some ways, the religion of salvation in the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, tends to be more corporate salvation, salvation of the people. And again, to grossly generalize, in the New Testament, there tends to be more of a focus on individual salvation, the salvation of individuals. What I want to talk a little, it's been suggested, and I think rightly, that every geographical environment suggests and informs the spirituality of that place. And how many of you have been to Holy Land? Been to the Holy Land? You've been there. I've not been there, though my family is from that part of the country, part of the world. It's not a very hospitable environment, is it? It's hot. It's desert. There's not a lot of water. It's a rough environment. In some ways, it's a paradigm for, again, as you suggested last night, up until very recently, the way the whole world was vis-a-vis the human race. It's only been very recently that all of nature really was much more of a threat than a sanctuary. And the suggestion is that in some ways what informed the Judeo-Christian tradition was from the beginning, the wilderness not as a place, although it was a place that some revelation was had, not a place where one went to for spiritual sustenance, but a place from which one escaped. And so therefore, rather than the wilderness, it is the walled garden, is often in Muslim art as well, the place of sanctuary, the place of having arrived. So although it is true that the monks and the those eating wild locusts would go into the wilderness for spiritual enlightenment, it was always coming back away from that in some sense was to arrive. And so if you accept that theory, in some way the part of the mythology of Judeo-Christian tradition is this kind of relationship to the wilderness. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about myth, and I have an exotic intellectual definition, which I think is fun. You know, it's hard to get at first, but just put it in the crock pot and stir it for a few months and you'll like it, I think. A myth is directions for the orchestration and recognition of life's energies. It took me about a year to figure that out, but it's nice. Have any of you heard of Gertrude Nelson? Good Lutheran writer, dances with God. She asked her daughter what myth meant, and I think her daughter was like 8 or 9, and she said, myths are stories which aren't true on the outside, but are true on the inside. Hey. Ooh. Blessed are the children. So that's a good way to put it. Okay, so Turner's thesis is this, that the conquest in some sense, the miracle that within just several very tiny generations, an entire continent could be transformed from a primal place to one under very much the control of human technology. What is it that could possibly make such an enormous change? And here's a man who certainly doesn't consider himself a Christian, but he said that this is essentially not just an economical, regional, political story, but a spiritual one. And he talks about the writing of this book. He said, "What I wanted to write about was my vivid sense, let me risk calling it a vision, that the real story of the coming of European civilization to the wildernesses of the world is a spiritual story. To me, it is the story of a civilization that had substituted history, one kind of myth, for myth as a way of understanding life. It was precisely this substitution that enabled Europeans to explore the most remote places of the globe, to colonize them, and to impose their values on the native populations." And then he tells a story. "The vision began, as the reader will see, on a day I spent roaming the hot and windy hills of the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. I saw myself there as both an inheritor of conquest and as an alien. I knew that both the Lakota and the Cheyenne had held sacred the Black Hills I could see in the westward distance, but I knew also that a belief in the sacredness of lands was not in my heritage. The distance I felt there was more than geographical. I could see the Black Hills. I was on a piece of Aboriginal America. But I was estranged by history from them. Isn't that lovely? So that is his thesis, that the history of the colonization and exploitation of North America was essentially the tremendous power of one myth over another myth.
Did he also say that that we have a historical tradition from the Hebrew, you know, the mighty acts of God, mm-hmm. and the recording of those, and God's history of salvation? Is that
He doesn't enter into that a lot. I mean, he's very much I would love to have had someone like this take a couple of years in seminary and work on this material again, because when he talks about history and about Christianity, it's clear that he's read no theology, no church history.
It's just not a history of the conquest of North America, but it's a whole civilization built on history as the prime.
That's right.
Human history is the primal thing.
That's right.
Instead of myth.
That's right. And he sees the Christian dimension to that as spiritually very destructive. And, you know, one reads this book and you have to be clear from the start that he's ambushing Christianity in many ways. No, it's not. It's definitely an ambush. And so you have to take that as part of it. But it's something also with which I think we need to deal. And I don't know why. I was thinking the other day, why do I stay in the church? You know, but it's always been my collisions with Christianity, be it ecology or Jewish Christian issues or feminism. It's always in those collisions where I say, my God, what am I doing here? I can't be here. It's precisely in those places where I rub that I feel God digs deepest in me, and I always return, and then I always, you know, I come to places like this and go to church and I meet people I love and I say, well, this is, you know, the church has sin like the rest of the world, but this is the place I want to be. So the critiques help me. Any other comments on what I've said so far?
Is this a recent book or one?
I think it was written, he's got another one called, I swear, since motherhood, my brain has turned to mush. I can remember my shopping list, but I can't.
What's the author's name?
Frederick Turner.
Well, that's the famous historian.
Is that the famous historian?
I don't know.
Grandson of the original.
I think, he's lived, yeah.
This guy, it sounds like a continuation of what...
Really? Well, yeah. Those of you who know more history than I do.
Yeah.
He's also written a more recent book called Rediscovering America, which is a biography of John Muir, which is just wonderful. It'll just make you weep. This is, this is pretty new. Well, second printing, 86. Oh, we're talking old, 37. Oh, no, that's it. That's when he was born. 1980. Okay, 10 years old. Okay, I'll proceed here. So he calls this book an essay in spiritual history. So what I want to talk about in a very generalized way is something about, and he doesn't go in this at all, this is mostly me, this part. Good example to start off what I want to say, I took a walk this morning, thanks to Linda who gave me her spot, with Gertrude, last name?
Lindholm.
And it was wonderful. I had to leave half an hour early because of the kids, but it was just wonderful. And she not only identified the plants, but she told some stories about some of the plants. And one of the things that was called like bed broom or something. And she said some stories say that it's good for the Indians used it for bedding. She said some say that this is the plant that lined Jesus' manger. And she said we don't know if it's true or not, but that's okay. That's myth, right? That's myth. That's myth. And. So what are some, and you folks help me with this, I could think of a few without thinking too hard. What are, in primal, it's primitive, I prefer the word primal peoples, what are some of the mythologies, the way the culture works, with which all of this will collide? I mentioned yesterday the story of the hero or the heroine, and Joseph Campbell goes into this so well. The wilderness is a place that the hero or heroine travels, and in some ways it doesn't conquer that, but submits to it, often either going out or more often going inside and finding there often dragons and devils, and in some sense submitting and coming out the other side. So that's one dimension. Bonding, in some sense, to forces greater themselves, forces greater than themselves, is opposed to a power with, linking with the powers within the earth, as the young woman with the dark hair who has the goddess talks about the power of the earth, as opposed to this myth of power over. Another thing that occurred to me, animals. What is our relationship to these animals who may or may not have souls? Very often, animals are teachers, guides. My cat Twinkle had a soul. I can tell you she haunts me still. Totems. Animals, again, who have their own power, which in some way a human being can become linked with. So the relationship with animals, again, I think as Campbell put so well, in primal peoples, when you slay an animal, what happens? What's that relationship? It's one where you become linked with the animal. There are rituals around it. The Inuit today still, when they kill the whale, it's a relationship. It's a relationship. It's a connection, and it's not simply the ending of a life. And it's a way of sometimes a fragment of the animal's body will be thrown back as a way to ensure the continuity. And first salmon ceremonies are such a good example of that sense of connectedness and the fragility of the human. And so that leads me to the next one, a sense in vis-a-vis nature of humility, a sense of being smaller. I remember one of the first sermons I ever preached on this topic a number of years ago was one where I talked about the contrast in some sense of the paradox of being in nature, or being in a city where the buildings are so tall and feeling small, and yet being in the woods and feel that the trees are so small, and I'm so small, so large, and I'm so small, and yet in that very smallness, feeling a sense of being a part of something very, very large. The Book of Job is a good thing to reread, because what's the answer at the end of all this? His travails. But what does God say? Where were you? Where were you when I laid the foundations of the world? And that's not as much an accusation or a sense of I know more than you do, but a sense of proportion and a sense always of relationship. And finally, and Linda brought this up yesterday, somewhat in the class and somewhat afterwards, a very different attitude towards death. How true the book Denial of Death is about I think the Western myth. It has a lot to do with the terrible fear of death and the desire to overcome it and eradicate it, to make another gross generalization. You see it in our medical technologies, and I know a lot of medical professionals who struggle with this. So in a more primitive, primal way of looking at death and life is a sense of circle. Perhaps not of ending. But a circle and a continuity. Gertrude pointed out a cottonwood that on a trail, one dying, and just a few feet away, one coming to life. And it's almost a circle. I mean, you see the big tree like this, and then it's not looking so good. And just over here, there's one coming up. So, okay. Postmythic, again, forgive these generalizations, and I'll apologize for us later and talk about how 2020 is hindsight, so don't worry, I'm not accusing our ancestors too much. A sense of power over, a sense that of possession. One of the things that the Indians in this country could never understand was this sense of ownership, which is one reason they got took so often. This wasn't a part of it. A sense that land is ours to take and that you own it. Ownership is something to reform. The wilderness is dangerous, which indeed it was. Well, that's the same thing, ours. The sense that there is nothing there. You know, the sense that the wilderness has nothing really living. And as you mentioned, we call it a resource. It's a utilitarian, something we use. But there's nothing out there.
I always have students who talk about the desert, oh, there's nothing there.
Yeah, right. There's nothing, there. And then you meet a woman like Gertrude, and it's like putting on a hole in the head. So, and then this is the big one. What, if you can read my Greek here, no end. That's a big one, isn't it? I think that was a real sense of this country, was that you know, at one time the state of Pennsylvania supposedly, have you ever heard this, that a squirrel could go across that whole state and never touch the ground? And at one time, I'm sure that's what this continent looked like. So that the thought that, you know, particularly in, you know, this country and Europeans coming over here, no end. You know, you go to Ephesus and you're talking about that. Those hills all used to be treated. You know, there's not a lot there then. They kept backing up because of what humans did. So it seemed like there were no their end. And we'll get into this a little bit. The sense that it is God's will. God's will. We'll get into that a little bit. And I just want to quote a couple things. Any comments before I go on? I'm talking more today than usual, but I will stop in about 10 minutes. This is a wonderful book, Touch the Earth, compiled by T.C. McLuhan. Nice, easy paperback with some beautiful pictures. Look at that face. Isn't that wonderful? It's just wonderful. And it's called A Self-Portrait of Indian Existence, and it's got quotations from Native Americans from contact on. And there are a couple of quotes in here that'll put into language what I'm trying to talk about. Born on March 20th, 1870, one Tatanga Mani, or Walking Buffalo. We were a lawless people, but we were on pretty good terms with the Great Spirit, creator and ruler of all. You whites assumed we were savages. You didn't understand our prayers. You didn't try to understand. When we sang our praises to the sun or moon or wind, you said we were worshiping idols. Without understanding, you condemned us as lost souls just because our form of worship was different from yours. We saw the Great Spirit's work in almost everything, sun, moon, trees, winds, and mountains. Sometimes we approach the Great Spirit through these things. Was that so bad? I think we have a true belief in the Supreme Being, a stronger faith than that of most whites who have called us pagans. Indians living close to nature and nature's ruler are not living in darkness. Did you know that trees talk? Well, they do. They talk to each other, and they'll talk to you if you listen. Trouble is, white people don't listen. They never learned to listen to the Indians, so I don't suppose they'll listen to other voices in nature. But I've learned a lot from trees, sometimes about the weather, sometimes about animals, sometimes about the Great Spirit. That one always chokes me up. And another one from here. This is Chief Luther Standing Bear, Oglala Sioux. We did not think of the great open plains, the beautiful rolling hills and winding streams with tangled growth as wild. Only to the white man was nature a wilderness, and only to him was the land infested with wild animals and savage people. To us, it was tame. Earth was bountiful, and we were surrounded with the blessings of the great mystery. Not until the hairy man from the east came and with brutal frenzy heaped injustices upon us and the families we loved was it wild for us. When the very animals of the forest began fleeing from his approach, then it was that for us the, quote, Wild West began. Let's brainstorm for a minute. What are your associations with savage and primitive? In terms of people, let's just talk about people, not the land. What tend to be stereotypes that you associated with primitives?
Inferior.
Inferior in what way?
No, I suppose thinking.
Thinking.
Being able to organize things.
Being able to organize.
Definition of progress.
Progress.
Definition of progress.
Right. And progress is very much sort of follows from all of this, doesn't it? Thomas Berry calls that sort of the current dream is an entrancement with the myth of progress. What else are we associated with?
Low technology.
Little technology.
Low. I mean, unsophisticated.
Right.
Primitive.
Lack of complex, not complex technology.
Lack of complexity.
Not controlled.
Not controlled.
Uncivilized.
uncivilized.
Superstitious.
Superstitious. Now, there's a heavily laden word.
Magical.
Magical. Now, that scares people.
Wild.
Wild. Good. Just before I left Seattle, I saw a play called The Kentucky Cycle. Anyone from Seattle or Tacoma? Got to see it. And it's the story, it's a 6-hour play over 200 years of the history of three families and first contact with the red women, up to strip mining up till 1975. And what that whole play is about is precisely what we've been talking about. It's all about the giving of the blankets with smallpox virus on them. It's all about the incomprehension of ownership of the Indians. It's all about the links between moving forward in time, the links between impoverization of the land and impoverization of the people. Very poignant moments when we were getting into the coal era, when so-called hillbillies were approached, and great promises: if you sell us your land for 40 cents an acre, we will get the rocks out of your land and we'll make some money. And there was a very poignant scene where the guy who was kind of hustling was walking to the road with the sort of sweet young thing, and she was saying, "Oh, I'd love to go to Louisville," and blah blah blah. And she was very excited. And he turned to her and he said, "You know, I'm a con man. Don't believe anything I say. You've got to listen to me. Here is the feedback." He said, "If you come in, this great oak that you love will be cut down. Your waters will become poisoned." And she said, No. And so she didn't listen to him. It's just an incredible drama. I wish I could show that play to the leaders of the nations, because it was just incredibly powerful, and it tells that story. But somehow I tried to do this and it didn't work. Oh, wait, let's see. Can I get it to go around? Okay, maybe we have to just turn it around. Or do you just do it like that?
Oh, okay. That's something to do.
Great, thanks.
Now it's all upside down.
It's all upside down. Okay, turn it back and I guess we'll turn it around.
Turn it around, yeah.
And then we'll just turn the whole, yeah, great. Thanks a lot.
It's still upside down.
That's great. Thank you. Great, thanks a lot.
I saw what looked like a Greek word there for a minute.
My Greek is So what I want to move into now, in terms of talking of myth, is, and this in part draws upon Turner, is how the Christian story connected conveniently with that myth. Yeah.
Was there a dark side to the Native mythology?
I'm sure there is. I'd like to read a book about it.
I mean, they did also war on each other.
They warred on each other.
But I'm always suspicious when we always... Mm-hmm. Pull the best out of somebody else and the worst out of our own. And
that's right.
It makes an interesting contrast,
right.
But I'm not sure.
That's right.
I don't know the dark
And they raped
side
the
of
land. I mean, they were, as you said last night. Yeah,
not particularly, I don't think.
Well, my understanding is that they did, but there were fewer of them and they could move further. And
no, it's
so
a hunting-gathering society over a vast continent. They couldn't have
there was
much
a lot
impact
fewer.
On a rich continent like this.
But maybe the point is that where they did, it would have... The degree was the same as now, but it was a smaller scale.
Mm-hmm. And then they would move on. That's what a hunting-gathering society is. It just doesn't impact the total.
Right. Well, tribes vary, too.
Mm-hmm.
And without the technology to do it on such a vast scale. But that's a great question. Let's talk about that more.
I think also that's important is that Indians weren't one people. I mean,
right.
They were many, many different tribes with their own cultures. And some were much more violent than others.
Mm-hmm.
The Northwest Indians in around Seattle were raided repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
They'd taken slaves, and the Tlingit and all those would come down and pick up slaves, and because they ran, they had to have some labor while they were doing all these wonderful artwork and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, back there.
The dark side of the artwork.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
The dark side. Mm-hmm. I think
explaining the good to people, it would have more power if that were recognized.
Sure.
And for me, one of the things was, there again, I suppose, for specific tribes, that your manhood or your success was based on stealing horses or scalping somebody or killing somebody, and that was your badge of manhood or honor, which is not certainly to me a dark side.
Sure. Sure.
Your life was kind of short, I imagine, in that kind of situation. I mean, guess I wouldn't. I would like to trade. Wouldn't want to trade longevity for a very hard existence, I imagine.
And I wouldn't want to live in a culture without Novocaine.
I guess I wouldn't want to live in a tiki in the middle of winter on the high plains.
That's right. That's right. And I think, you know, we have to be very conscious. And I'm glad that we raised this. That in our hunger, in some sense, for an enlarged myth and one which can speak to where we are, we don't romanticize another era, nor, and this became particularly clear to me when my husband and I first met, who he lived in Turkey for a number of years and come into a lot of contact there and elsewhere with missionaries to China and elsewhere. And it's very easy in a similar way to downtrod and criticize the 19th century missionary movement of the Christian Church as imperialistic, colonialistic, but patriarchal, blah, 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 blah. And it's easy to speak in vast generalities and, number one, overlook the good work that was done in the best sense, the sense that it was intended in the best of ways. And finally, that consequences are often unseen, and so that those are all parts of it too. And it's very easy to hindsight is 20/20 to look back and make these kind of criticisms. And that's, if one isn't careful, that's a cop out. So I just get into that. And the other thing is, and Turner's very good about this, is that much less well known than some of the Daniel Boones and so forth, and he chronicles some, were some very countercultural exceptions within American history. And I haven't yet seen a book about that, but there must be, I'm sure there is. There were a lot of exceptions to the pervading mentality, and many of them, I'm sure, were people of faith. And the other point he makes, and he has some hysterical quotes about white people, that the children or others who for one way or another had come into contact and stayed there with Indian culture, and Dances with Wolves is a good example, who were then attempted to be rescued by white men, and they didn't want to go, and they had to be dragged in chains back to civilization. But anyway, so it's a remarkable book. What I'd like to do for a few minutes, I've got some more things I want to say, but what I'd like to do for about 15 minutes or so is ask you, I can come up with some names I can think of, we'll go back to that. What are some names of Christian or others? What I'm trying to do today is try to focus on the particularly American myth. What are some examples of Christian or other Americans that have had a more primal view towards the wilderness that have influenced you? And I'll just write down a few that I can think of, and I'm sure you can come up with a lot more. I mentioned before John Muir. He's a big one for me. Well-known Aldo Leopold, Wisconsin. Okay. Rachel Carson. one of my very favorites, I read it when I was 10, Never Cry Wolf, Harley Moat. Great. Others, especially, you know, Americans, Canadians.
Yes, Thoreau.
Thoreau, of course.
Yeah. Christian?
Pardon?
Was he Christian?
Either, both. I don't think it's Christian or otherwise. Jack London? Okay, great. Because I think there's something to the what has now become, thank God, so much of a global movement of spirituality and action. I think that there's great spiritual resources that the American experience has to bring. Others?
Sigurd Olson.
Sigurd Olson. Great.
Alex Haley?
Alex Haley. Sure. Now, someone of you who mentioned somebody, tell me what it is about that person's vision that for you has enabled a counter-myth vision of the wilderness. And someone that, one of your favorites. Tell me what it is about, tell each other what that person's vision was that captivated and inspired you. Boy, was she ahead of her time. I think for me, Farley Mowat so well combined the vision of the commonality between the plight of the of wildlife and the plight of the peoples. In the book People of the Deer, for example, if you put People of the Deer and Never Cry Wolf together, for me he linked so well the pathos of wildlife and human life together, and the loss, the irrecoverable loss. So he combined the passion of the anthropologist with the passion of the naturalist in some wonderful ways. Were you going to say something?
A name that's not up there that's impacted me a lot is Norman Cousins, and I think he had a broader vision than just, you know, ecology, spirituality, and the like. But I think that what really impacted me a lot from reading him very early on Saturday Review was there's something greater and more important, seemingly, than national lines, and you know, much more of a universal viewpoint about what was going on, whether it was the earth or it was humanity, that, you know, while nationalistic lines might be important, there's always something greater and more important than that, and it was kind of a flavor of that. So this isn't just ours. I think it addressed some of those things you were talking about on the other side, the ours and possession kind of thing.
I'm really glad you brought up the point of nationalism, because flipping back to the other side of that list of sort of the Western myth culminating progress, I think the potential to make an idol of nationalism is very connected with all of these things. That a distortion of the tribal and how linked that is, and what, again, in the name of good, what is done. And it's so wonderful to hear that. I hadn't heard the war prayer for many years till this morning. If I'd read that during the Gulf War, I think I just would have cried in my bed for a day.
I thought of another name, Donald Kovac.
Tell us about him. Anyone?
Donald Kovac Peaty, P-E-A-T-T-I-E.
Okay, tell us about him.
Well, he was a great naturalist. I think he started out as a biologist. Anyway, he's not in this generation, one back. Mm-hmm. He wrote this Flowering Earth, and he has or had a respect for all living things, and his writings are just full of that respect for life, all life.
Wonder if he's in print.
Oh yes, sure that at least, well maybe.
Great.
I think at least his Flowering Earth is. I think his essays maybe.
Great. Good.
The thing Sigurd Olsen was able to do in his essays in the Vondelaars is to take an intangible, like timelessness, as an example, and just talk about how that area and that experience makes him think of that and raise that out.
Yeah, and you reminded me as you were talking of another of my favorite, Peter Matthiessen. Okay, I'm going to challenge all of us to a question. What is it? Most of the people, if not all that we've mentioned, are not explicitly religious, much less Christian. What is it that to and for you as a Christian speaks to your belief and hope in God through these people?
Spiritual.
How? Say more. What about Sigurd Olsen connects with you about God and Jesus and Spirit and your Christian faith? How does that nurture your faith in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Sarah? Or maybe you're going to have to come up with an answer right away. Think about it. Yeah.
I was going to say, it's their perspective of reality.
Mm-hmm.
you know, their, how they view reality and nature and how they view reality.
Say more.
Well, it's just that they look at the world through the eyes of their spiritual belief.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
I think it's a sense of connectedness instead of separation.
I want to put up Carol Sagan's name.
Carl Sagan, yeah.
The whole Cosmos series, I think, did a lot on the popular media for so many people who won't make the time to read a book, but somehow was able to produce something that was catchy and attractive, and it enthralled me.
I'm glad you raised that. Mm-hmm. Right. Other series, nature series, some of the other things, and just the ministry in some sense of talk about bringing reality alive of wildlife photographers and so forth.
Who's the woman author, Pilgrim and Tinker's Creek?
Oh, Annie Dillard.
Annie Dillard,
yeah. Mm-hmm. She's great. Oh, boy, her comments about the Anglican Church are just right. Talk about wanting to control God. Read Pilgrim and Tinker Creek, and even if you're not Episcopalian, you're just going to die laughing.
Stephen Gould.
Right.
I can't think of any right now, but there's any number of poets who are known for good relationship to nature. To me, most of their metaphors and images come out of nature.
Right. Gerard Manley Hopkins, lots of others.
Yeah.
I remember as a child, the movie Born Free had a tremendous impact on me, and just a few years ago when, tell me their names, Joy.
Jim.
Yeah, he was murdered, you know, he was murdered. And I felt, I just wept and wept and wept, and I thought, what's going on inside of me? And it felt like, you know, I saved the clipping for the paper and put it in my journal, and I just thought, without either of those two people in that particular area of Kenya, it was sort of what was between, they were what was between the guns and some of that wildlife, and it just felt like the end of an era. Anyway, yeah.
For me, the visual, I think like the artist, George O'Keefe.
George O'Keefe.
Herbert Hamilton had brought it alive with the almost religiousness with rendering what they had done living in the West with the Indians.
Ansel Adams,
yeah. Elliot Porter. Yeah.
Yes, I'd like to share a lot of those I've read, and maybe it's their sense of being called to accountability that comes through.
Mm-hmm.
That when we do these wrong things, we're not going to get away with them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of my sense of God. He gave us this earth as a gift. And if we do the wrong thing, we're not going to get away with it in the end.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to pay attention along the way. He's going to get away with it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that.
I'm touched by their love of all creation, but also by their far-sightedness and the broad perspective. I think what you were saying, that, that oftentimes we get so hooked up in our own perspective that we lose sight of things, and that they are able to step outside and see a much larger perspective, and not just to the point of seeing how small we are in comparison to all creation, but just also how we fit into it.
Yeah, yeah. So again, that the sense of connection, and the word love keeps coming up. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Appreciation for beauty. Yeah.
I was thinking of some books like Bird Baylor and Peter Parnell. They do, you know, about celebrations and hawk on your brother, and some of those that I found such a response to young children. But this last year, I came upon, I think it was about 10 books by Paul Vogel. I don't know.
Don't know.
Beautiful picture books with kind of a Native American theme, and just some wonderful values things in there.
Mm-hmm.
The children that I read them to, you said, "Do you want to read more?" Beautiful, brilliant artwork.
Mm-hmm.
The themes are just very touching about Native
Mm-hmm. What would the name again? Peter
Paul Goebel.
Paul Goebel. Okay.
Yeah, I was looking for that book.
Yeah. Anyone else familiar with Paul Goebel?
And I would say for kindergartners through.
Right. I'm really impressed with some of the books in the bookstore for children on these things, and there's a wonderful bookstore in Seattle called The Secret Garden that is very strong on these things. Did you want to say something? Or you just sort of...
Oh, I always want to say something, but no.
Okay. Let me read something from the end that I think summarizes well what he's trying to say. I was going to go a lot into this, but I think we've already covered a lot of it and did before. And in some sense, and again, we cannot, it's too easy to castigate the blindness of our ancestors. Yeah.
One of the things that catches me, and it was your word at the end, I think there is a valuing as sacred the land and all that you catch in a number of these authors and a few others, that I think that we, within a Christian tradition, those of us out of it, have often lost, that we have really lost a sense of the sacred, the holy, that we are in a holy place. And that's what strikes me about Carl Sagan, who, you know, has written some very anti-Christian kind of things, I think probably for good reason, coming from his perspective, values so much of the cosmos as sacred.
Well, you just stole the last line of my
life. Oh, I'm sorry.
What I was going to do to sum all of this up was precisely that with regard to the land, that in common to both mythologies is a sense of holiness, one of relatedness and attachment in that way, and the other in a sense of control, and that both regard the land in that way as holy, but in very different ways. And for Christians, and again, you know, and again, looking historically, it's easy to look 2020, but there was a sense that the wilderness, in terms of becoming a holy, it had to be made holy. Something had to be introduced to it. Technology, civilization, alteration, and that itself would be for the good, not that what was there was in itself holy. And in some sense, that's the bottom line of the collision of the myths. You know, the expression God forsaken, right? And the people in the land is God forsaken. And so God is brought to the savages. The land itself is improved. And if you read some of the speeches of Cortez, I mean, it's just shot through with a sense of the destiny and the ministry and modern jingo, that is what we are here for. And did any of you see the movie The Mission?
Mm-hmm.
That comes to mind. That, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you saw it? Yeah, that was that.
I did have a speech here at the end. The sense of the sacred. Can we tie that in some way to the story in the Garden of Eden, where God said, "Leave this tree alone."
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have modern society doesn't have that sense of discipline to leave something alone.
Right.
Everything is open, and if we can get at it, we do it.
Right.
And they went at it in the Garden of Eden, and that's what happened. And it wasn't that the tree in the Garden of Eden was specifically encased in smoke and all that, so we absolutely couldn't get at it. It was there.
Right.
They went after the fruit of the tree.
Right.
The point of the tree story is that still wanted to know who was God, and I guess the issue, and I think that's what you're getting at, is that we've played God with the universe, with creation. And as soon as that has happened, that's exactly it. That's a great I never made that connection until you said that. It's very good.
We've tried to play God.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that was my early sense of in the early 70s when we had to crawl all about the North Slope of Alaska and tear that all up. Couldn't we leave something alone just for the sake of some self-discipline?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had to go and exploit everything we can get at.
Right. It's interesting in that vein to hear the debates about Antarctica right now. Very poignant.
So they don't find oil there.
Oh,
Antarctica. Yeah.
We're the only country that voted against some kind of treaty.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me just read you a few things from the end. Part of the reason I love to read him is that his prose is so beautiful. And like letter writing. You know, it's rare that you read really beautiful writing sometimes by by almost anybody. And this sort of sums it. The end is called the Vanishing New World. And this is a longish quote, so just relax. Living in a land so transformed by the burdens we brought, we find it almost incredible that North America was not long ago an unscarred place of overpowering beauty and fecundity, where the hand of humankind was dark, aboriginal, and mythologically bound, so that it brushed but lightly on its environment. Traveling the cancerous stretch of the eastern seaboard from the English outposts in Massachusetts down through the outer banks of North Carolina and on into the island of Flowers, Florida. I had from Florida the other day, where Soto and Narvaez trudged off on their nightmare errands. We have some trouble imagining either beauty or fecundity. The old chronicles that tell of these seem travelers' tales to us now, though we have no doubt that we are in the presence of tremendous industry and power. Nothing less could have changed this landscape so totally from what it once was, that even with our narrative guides, we are at a loss to find vestiges of that old new world. For most of us, even more unsuspected and irrecoverable, are the forces that nerved and sinewed our industry and that drive us still toward the acquisition and consumption of more and more power. For what underlay our clearing of the continent were the ancient fears and divisions that we brought to the new world, along with the primitive precursors of the technology that would assist in transforming the continent. Haunted by these fears, driven by our divisions, we slashed and hacked at the wilderness we saw, so that within 3 centuries of Cortez's penetration of the mainland, a world millions of years in the making vanished into the voracious, insatiable maw of civilization. And then just another line. Only when the new world had been pruned and leveled so that none need fear becoming lost in it, and its remnant natives had been disarmed and corralled, could Europeans finally begin to rest easy in their possession. And it was at that moment in our history that we began to experience the spiritual enormity of what had been done here. He concludes that later, that the missed opportunity, he says, for spiritual growth and renewal, he says, that comes once to a civilization that was lost. And I don't quite agree with him. I think that although very little remains certainly of the original civilization of the Native Americans, and very little remains of really wild places, even Antarctica. As you may have clued in since I came here and began talking at all, I'm optimistic in that I really feel that this is a turning point of some enormity in our generation. And I take my hope from the voices such as yours and others that I hear all over, and even in Seattle, where I come from, organizations that only 5 years ago were really left-wing and struggling and 501c3s scratching and clawing to get solvent are all of a sudden becoming mainstream. I really feel that some changes are beginning to happen, and I just wanted to throw that out before we conclude to test that sentiment. How do you all feel in terms of optimism or pessimism as to whether a new mythos, a new way of looking at the story of the deeper meaning of reality can begin to be changed? And since you only have 5 minutes, you don't have to think too hard. But just off the top of your head, how do you all feel? Can we change?
Yes. We have to take the profit out, I think.
Okay.
In order to make meaningful changes.
Take the...
Well, we have to, for instance, boil.
Mm-hmm.
As long as that is means money, and money means power. I don't think that we're going to stop depleting world resources for respecting the continental shelf and wildlife that's there.
think another way to say what she's saying is that the greatest devastation began after the accumulation of capital.
Capital.
The Native American, they were using enough to get by, but they weren't stockpiling it for whatever future generations might need, or sending kids off to college and
right.
stuff like that.
Good point.
In the Northwest, one of the, I think, really watershed decisions was a bold decision. That was almost 20 years ago. So I don't think anybody has to claim that we're just starting now.
Right.
These four decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
The bold decision is very controversial.
Can you say just a little bit about that for those that aren't from this region?
It's about allocating about half the salmon catch to the Native Americans because that's their livelihood. And the sport fishermen get the rest, and the commercial fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
And this decision has almost been overturned a couple of times. And it's a tremendous thing. The man who wrote it was a fairly sophisticated man, but he'd been in Alaska and stuff like that.
He's a Christian, too.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
but they're still
mm-hmm.
fighting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're really fighting, and mm-hmm. that's what tells you when economics are tied into
mm-hmm.
well, a resource
right.
And recreation, then you're going to get a lot of fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But it was there. It's already there.
Mm-hmm.
It's in place.
Any other final?
Touch and go?
Touch and go.
Yeah,
okay.
And I think the change has to be a very radical change. You can't just patch things and fix things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think it's such an issue to me.
Sometimes I worry it's the circles I run in and I get optimistic because everyone thinks
right.
like me.
Right.
I get to think. Then I go out and watch how people react to the land, just to observe
right.
them.
Right.
For example, when you fly across country in an airplane, that people don't care where you are.
Right.
Or what the land looks like.
Right.
Go to Las Vegas and watch someone pull a slot machine. I don't want
yeah.
to cut these people
right.
down.
Right.
There's a powerful engine of.
Right.
That's been set in the other direction with
right.
a lot of people and a lot of interest behind it. I wouldn't
right.
I wouldn't either be optimistic or pessimistic. I finally don't think those are Christian words. I mean,
right.
Or healthy realism
right.
about a human's ability to screw things up and,
right.
and a hope because you know that there's something else besides humans at work in the midst of that.
Right.
Whereas optimism and pessimism are the light and dark side
right.
of phenomena.
There are more,
it's really
more
helpful.
People in this world day, who screw it up.
Right.
As our population goes
right.
crazy, then...
And just supporting that, you can't support a world of 5.2 billion people without
right.
modern technology.
Right.
Sorry, you just cannot do it.
Two more comments, or three, yeah.
I